Revelation chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne, and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. By way of remembrance, this collective group of 144,000 covenant members of his church in heaven, this body, they sing to the finality of all his work in bringing them to heaven. One of the descriptions is that they sound as one voice. I heard a voice from heaven. They all speak as one. They're all unified. They are unified with a voice like the voice of many waters and like a great thunder. The truth they sing and declare concerning being redeemed, they know what that is. They know what that means. Only they can sing that song. They follow Christ. They worship him. They follow him for who he is, for who they are, for the truth contained in the gospel, and for the truth in his revealed will for their lives. These redeemed have certain characteristics. They're redeemed. They're pure. They are not defiled. That is, that they had not committed spiritual adultery, and they are spiritually pure and doctrinally pure, and they are virgins. They would never defile themselves in spiritual adultery against the slain lamb and their king. They're not wayward. They keep themselves for him alone. In this, they're perfectly committed to him and follow him wherever the lamb goes. There's no guile in their mouths. That's because they're singing praises, all based on the truth. They are not like the devil, who's treacherous, sly, crafty, and tricky. They're not like the serpent in the garden. They are without those traits. They are pure, as pure virgins. Guile cannot be found in their mouths. Their mouths are filled with praise, and it's praise according to the truth. And in following such, there is communion that they have with the Lamb. Here, then, is to be considered. The saints follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes in all providences, whether in times of ease or times of hardship. Times of ease and times of affliction are such things by way of the saints' perception on earth. In heaven there is only rest. In heaven they do the Father's will perfectly. In heaven they have perfect union and communion with the Lamb. In heaven, regardless of where he goes, they will follow the Lamb in heaven. Now, following is easy in heaven. And in heaven there are no distractions. Their entire focus is on the Lamb, on his worship, and on being near to him, so that wherever he goes, they will go. They do not desire Christ to ever be at a distance from them. They always desire perfectly to be near and close in communion with him. On earth, this is different, because being near to Christ is mingled with the fall and mingled with sin. Believers are not free from the hindrances of sin, and having a time of ease is one of perception. Often, for many Christians, it's the reality of considering following Christ in a kind of wayward delusion. For if the Christian thinks that his life is a life of ease in comparison to others, there are certain qualifications of what that means for them, though they might not have even considered it. And though they might not be in some outward affliction, or what they would perceive is an outward affliction, and so think it's a time of ease, they may be, in fact, be making headlong in a great spiritual war and not even know it. Consider, for example, a man that is a Christian, and his sin is one of a lack of trust. This is attached to most of the commandments. But for reasons of provision, he sometimes allows himself to distrust God and his worldly goods, so he feels safer when he has his livelihood set, and his home is orderly, and his job is secure, and his finances are fine, and his bills are paid. And so, in such a situation, he feels at ease. And yet, he may not even recognize that being in such a time of ease, God has so ordered it to prove out his faith to see how much he'll go to him, to trust him. In these times of ease, where the world, the flesh, and the devil can wreak havoc on a soul in such a time without them even knowing it. To leave off their duties because God seems to them to be very amiable to them, because they're always equating wrongly prosperity with ease. That can be very spiritually trying. A very hard, spiritually trying time for people without them even knowing it. Job was quickly relieved of his possessions and children in but an instant. And because believers are not free from sin, The more or less they consider their state and the providences around their state and determine in their own mind according to the Bible as best they can whether a time is a time of ease or a time of affliction. God certainly orders both as they appear to men while they're on the earth. But let's consider that God gives times of ease, and Christians ought to have an overall strategy of following Christ for those times. There's an overall understanding of times of ease and how they ought to be treated. Now, we're not going to get super specific, but general rules to apply generally as we generally understand it. It should be understood at all times, even in the times of suffering, that there can be times of ease. One can have a suffering time, and yet there is found a moment of respite. So regardless of the times, the perception of times of ease ought to be discerned. Depending upon the perception of the Christian, considering times in that way is somewhat difficult. One might think that in looking at one's life in its entirety, often the times of ease are relatively longer than times of suffering. Someone might conclude that. Some would seem to think that suffering is in shorter spurts than times of ease, which perceptibly seems to be longer. That might be, though greatly depending on where one lives, under what time they live, and circumstances and such. If a person lived during the time of the Black Plague a few hundred years ago, when it was on and off for so many years, seeing so much pain and death and poverty and being impoverished and seeing so much sickness, they may conclude in their time that they are under times of affliction, far longer than times of ease. Or it may be that some people live in times of war or times of famine. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress was written from a jail cell, and he mentions that when Christian climbed the hill of difficulty, he came to a place called ease, where he enjoyed the king's bounties, but it was short-lived. Bunyan was in jail, and that was not easy. His perception was that times of ease are far and few between, because one's life to it, they have to take upon the yoke of Christ, and to pick up one's cross, that's hard. Another person, they might live in the United States as it pertains to outward circumstances here in the 21st century, and they find they have a job and food and shelter and a family and sustenance and see very little perceived or actual suffering at all. There are no evil governments knocking on their door to pull them from their homes and throw them into the lion's den. At least not yet. They perceive that's a time of ease. But is their perception skewed? Is the slaughter of 65 million aborted children a time of ease? You see, it's by way of perception. Some people will look at their life, and no matter how good they may have it, always see the glass half empty. They are tempted to neglect times of ease when giving the story of their life, and they will say with Jacob, in describing their days and times on earth, as few and evil. Jacob said unto Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been." Genesis 47:9. Might be true, but still, it is somewhat the view of the pessimist. Yet the Christian believes in God's providence. Times of ease come from God as much as troubled times. They might even be mixed. Men do not create their own ease, and it's an unbiblical idea to think that men create their own ease, and all God ever does is press them in the winepress of troubles. Christ said, "My yoke is easy." Matthew 11:30. In the original, it does not mean that the Christian life is easy, as Christ's life is easy, but rather that the word signifies good and something more good in the highest degree, and it's rendered gracious. "If so be ye which have tasted, the Lord is gracious." 1 Peter 2:3, same idea. So Christ's yoke, the precepts which he lays on his disciples, are, he had said by him, not to be only a good yoke, but a gracious yoke. That any man is better for coming to him and taking this on him. That life is better. Luther translated it, that is, "My yoke is peace and my burden is joy." You see, they're easy in that sense. It seems that people often think that following Christ is hard when outward troubles are hard, and following Christ is easy when outward troubles do not exist by perception. But that's not really the biblical conception of following Christ, whithersoever he goes. Regardless of whether one perceives times of ease or times of afflictions, the duty to follow the Lamb stands no matter where he goes, for one does not desire to lose the nearness of Christ at any time. If times of afflictions are there, they want to be close to Christ so that they can be relieved. If times of prosperity are there, they want to stick close to Christ in case something does occur. What time might a Christian not need the nearness of the Lamb upon him? For any to be satisfied with less of a union at one time or another is to fall headlong into the road of apostasy. The saints in heaven follow the Lamb with us wherever he goes, and they are chaste and pure with no guile ever. Instead, regardless of the providence, the Christian should take certain truths to be evident from Scripture that they pertain to what they perceive to be times of ease and act accordingly. And there are certain truths that may be set there to consider. Times of ease on earth will never last forever in this life. Job will have a very prosperous time with great thoughts of how he and his children ought to serve God. I'm sure Job was a concerned parent. He said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Job 1:5. He had the heart of a father about his children. What of the burden of one person for another about their salvation? Is that a time of ease? Would Monica think it was a time of ease praying for his son Augustine with tears? Was that easy? And depending upon one's disposition, it's pointless to continually anticipate future trouble over and over and over in worldly things. One cannot control future events, as Christ says. "Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat, or what ye shall drink, nor yet for your body, what ye shall put on. Is not the life more than meat, and the body than raiment?" Matthew 6:25. Christ tells his disciples not to be anxious for anything. "Be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving let your requests be made known unto God." Philippians 4:6. The Apostle Paul likewise says the same thing. American Christians are so worldly minded, always thinking about what they will eat and what they will drink and what they will put on. Instead, the Christians ought to be prepared for difficult providences and times of ease by a constant nearness to God and following Christ with us wherever he goes. People pay for car insurance, but that does not mean that they are obsessed with thinking that every time they drive down the street, they're going to get into a car crash. Proper provision often can have the effect that set aside anxious thoughts. But for the Christian, they are required by God to be circumspect and to walk accordingly, always before God's face, and then they'll be ready for anything that he brings them. That's really the key, anything he brings them. "See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil." Ephesians 5:15-16. That means they are to walk closely near to the Lamb, whithersoever he goes, in times of ease or times of difficulty. And they are required to have a certain amount of perception of the uncertainty of life in order to anticipate some frowning providence that might befall them. And regardless of the times, they follow the slain Lamb whithersoever he goes. Does being in a time of prosperity make walking circumspectly less important? Or that one would not follow Christ whithersoever? Jesus promised that for the believer on earth, storms will come. It's one of the promises that are left out of those little books of promises. "In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." John 16:33. Where will the Christian be when the storms come? Hopefully, they will not be far from the Lamb. What will be their mindset? What will be their preparation? If they've been following the Lamb whithersoever he goes, they're near to him, and the storms might rage, but they dwell in safely. They apply walking with God in every circumstance, no matter what providences might come to them. So the Christian must consider that times of ease are not in themselves sanctuaries against coming signs of trouble. Job was an upright man who feared God and shunned evil, and yet in all his times of ease and prosperity, there is the book of Job. The devil's onslaught against him was ferocious. He lost everything but his life. "At least you have your health," some person might say to someone else. But with Job, he lost everything. He had much, a large family. He was very wealthy. But worldly things are not sanctuaries against times of trouble or what the people of God would perceive are troubles. Times of ease have no power to ward off times of trouble. Was it not the downfall of Dives, the rich man, to trust in his riches? Was it not the downfall of the rich man who wanted to inherit eternal life, his riches? Or of the rich man who built bigger barns to trust in what he had and eat and drink and be merry? Well, God calls him a fool. God calls them unprepared fools. God calls some virgins, 5 of the 10, that's half, unwise, foolish virgins. It's interesting about the virgins that they were virgins, that they were at the wedding, that they were waiting for the bridegroom, that they had lamps, that they knew that they should have oil, and yet were negligent, quite unprepared. I wonder how many foolish Christians there are. Christian professors will sometimes do much in what they think they should do with neglecting weightier matters of what God requires of them. The great temptation of those who have times of ease is to trust in those times for things that Such can never purchase and will leave them unprepared when the storms come. Prosperous people are often tempted to trust their prosperity as if it would always continue into the future. Such things are never promised here on earth in that regard. But whether it's a time of ease or a time of trouble, the believer follows the limb closely, whithersoever he goes, in truth, in all things, because of who Christ is and what they are in him, and they are knit to him. All of the things fade quickly away in their mind. And though it may be very hard work that brings a person to great prosperity, it's never something that can bring a soundness of mind. Rich people constantly commit suicide. You hear famous people all the time overdosing, killing themselves because riches and perceived prosperity or perceived times of ease have no power. What then should perceived times of ease do for the Christian? Well, they should help the Christian walk closely with Christ, whithersoever he goes, in a perceived easier walk. They should help the Christian make ready their gifts and graces for times of trouble or for any time. Genesis 41, 29 to 32. Behold, there come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, and there shall arise after them 7 years of famine, and all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine shall consume the land. And the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of the famine following, for it shall be very grievous. And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice. It is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So Joseph told Pharaoh to lay up stores during the 7 years of plenty in preparation for the coming 7 years of famine. There's a truth in that for the Christian. Pharaoh complied willingly, discerning the work of the Spirit of God in Joseph. Can we find such a one as this is a man in whom the Spirit of God is? But do Christians always heed the words of the preacher? Are they always as perceptive as Pharaoh were? The wise Christian will always strive to discern the signs of the times and will be prepared. It's easy to see in the time of Joseph over Egypt that the times of ease were times of work. Times of ease in God's providence is not to exercise sloth. Not even the rich man did that, though his priorities were wrong. He built bigger barns. Days of ease ought to afford the Christian the ability to walk closer with the Lamb and to be spiritually prepared, because when times of ease are easier, it is, by way of perception, easier to draw near to God for all intents and purposes. What wise man would ever wait until his death to have the power or mind enough to enter into a deeper religious walk with the slain Lamb? God calls those people fools. If you're not taking the time in the days of health to walk closer with Christ, or or that through the health of his life he did not follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes, will he be expected to be able to do it all at once on his deathbed? Were Job's children surprised by death? Was Elimelech surprised by death, or his sons? The day of one's death may surprise a man at any time, and the only safety is in following the Lamb whithersoever he goes while one is able and can, and to prepare and be ready for all that God will order in his life. That's why the apostle tells the Ephesians to redeem the time, because the days are evil. Don't wait. Be prepared now. It is not a great and high dignity that's given to man, that he may freely and frequently as he will converse with Christ while here on earth. Who made him the great King of heaven and earth? Is that not amazing? It's a wonder that the great God of heaven should honor poor sinners so much with the ability to have his ear. And yet, it's very strange that poor sinners who have such a great privilege, that the most part of them use such a privilege so little. It is not natural to seldom come to him in times of ease. Seldom do they offer violence to the kingdom in times of ease. And when they're pressed to look for him in times of afflictions and pains, commonly they try all other means rather than God's prescribed means, which was to stick close to him all the while, until that providence came up. They will try and work out their way as best they can. Here is Hagar, my handmaiden, Sarah said to Abraham. Oh, like ideas of that sort. Robert Lighton said, but such as have learned this way of laying their pained head and heart in his bosom, they are truly happy, though in the world's language they'd be never so miserable. Following the Lamb in the Lamb's way and taking up his will as law, then a man will be happy. Thomas Fuller said this, people who study nature, the naturalists, observe that whilst the halcyon bird is brooding her eggs and bringing forth her young ones, there is usually fair weather. from where we get the expression and call good times fair weather days or halcyon days. The bird does not neglect any of those days, but sits close upon her nest and is very diligent in bringing forth chicks, lest if there should be a change of weather, or the water should grow high and her young ones be in danger of drowning, well, this way, times of prosperity, Christians must provide for adversity. Lay hold of all the opportunities of peace and liberty to edify themselves in the most holy faith. This was the church's care in Acts 9:31, and this must be for all Christians. While our ship is in the haven, to mend it there. When it is out at sea in a storm, it will be too late for them then. There is yet some hope, but how long will there be? Only God knows. So let the Christian must provide for worser times, that they are not surprised all of a sudden when frowning providences come upon them. We must also consider God gives times of tribulation, and Christians ought to have an overall strategy of following Christ for those times. It's a truism that God's people seek him early and earnestly in affliction. Scripture is filled with instances for the proof of that. Exodus 2. When the Israelites were consumed in Egypt in that type of sin and misery, worn out, ground to pieces under cruel bondage in Egypt, they sighed, they groaned, they cried in their distress. They remembered their God, and God remembered them in his covenant. Verses 23 to 25. God looked on them with pity. And when the Lord had planned out the way of escape for them through his miracles and had brought them to the utmost brink of deliverance, there they encountered the most terrible danger that they had ever faced. They are shut in by the sea, Satan's army closely following behind them. The sea is set before them, an armed, enraged multitude behind them on both sides, impassable mountains. All this that they might be the more intent and importunate in seeking God. So they cry out to him. God rescues them. Afterwards, in times of ease and peace, prosperity, they revolt. It's a murmuring people over and over again. The Christian reads their narratives only to wonder at their incorrigibleness. Time and time again. How could they act so terribly towards God, the Christian thinks, without ever saying that as they stand in front of the mirror looking at how they act? And yet, as Stephen says, the church in the wilderness followed God whithersoever he led them. That is he that was in the church in the wilderness with the angels, which was spoken to him from Mount Sinai and with our fathers. Acts 7:38. How often they have found reduced, brought home by difficulties and miseries. Those that in their fullness and fatness promiscuously kick against God and lightly esteem the rock of their salvation. Deuteronomy 32:14. In their difficulties they are made to know and prize the necessity and worth of God, and accordingly to pursue him more violently. The heaviest calamity that they had in the Old Testament that ever came on them outside the wilderness wanderings was the Babylonian captivity. And in the deliverance there is seen the grand wonder of mercy, a lively resemblance of glorious redemption. When after their long and tedious slavery, the Lord would accomplish his goodness, his gracious thoughts in their return. See how he prepares them for mercy. Ye shall seek me and find me when ye shall search for me with all your heart. Jeremiah 29:10-14. David was a man who was always conversing and communing with God, yet most eager on him and close with him in afflictions. O God, thou art my God, he says, early will I seek thee. Psalm 63:1. He owns and assumes God and is up ahead of time to take hold of him. My soul thirsteth for thee, my flesh longeth for thee. All his parts and powers and faculties were desirously intent on getting him. And this was in a dry and barren land where there was no water, he said in Psalm 63. When he was parched with drought, could not gain a drop of refreshing but what he gathered from the fountain of Christ. The disciples walked with Christ, they heard his word, they saw his miracles, yet do we not find them at any time so instantly and vehemently pressing on him in the storm? Remember? In the storm. When they are ready to be drowned, they come unto him and awake him, saying, Lord, save us, we perish. Matthew 8:25. Affliction presses the Christian, but could they have all acted in a very different manner, in a more ready manner? Following the Lamb into affliction is hard, It is by grace. The Lamb brings his people into affliction for their good, and he does it that he might delight in his people, so he does it in that they might delight in him and to be sweet to them. When the whole world is following into disarray and difficulties on every side, he desires they follow him whithersoever he goes, that their communion with him deepens, not lessens. He embitters the world to them so that they're weaned from it. Often he does that in times of prosperity. He makes the world to hate them, that they may the more easily hate it. But they will only do so if they're prepared and taught. They will only do so by grace. They will only do so if they're walking with him circumspectly. He wants them not to allow themselves to settle in or on the world like Elimelech did in leaving the church for easier fields. Or so he thought. What an interesting work Ruth had on her heart not to abide in the works of Elimelech, instead be a follower of the true God nonetheless. She had the bad example of Elimelech to consider from marrying into the family, though she didn't even know him. She had the bad example, really, knowing after the fact of her husband who should have never married her. She had the bad example of the hypocrisy of Orpah, and yet she was of a different spirit. The world is an unpleasant place because of the fall, and Christ orders it in such a way as to make it unpleasant to his people by many sharp afflictions for their good. Why so? That they would stay close to him, following him no matter what, and that they may, with the more willingness, come off and be united to him, untied from the world, and that they may remember their true home all the more and seek their comforts from above. What does Colossians 3, 1 and 2 say? Seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth at the right hand of God. Set your affection on the things above, not on the things in the earth. That finding so little below, they may turn unto him and delight themselves in communion with him, Lighton said. In this they have to be exercising the graces of God's Spirit in times of trial as well as in times of ease, some of which have little or no use in times of prosperity as patience and some other things. If an Olympian wants to exercise their abilities at the Olympics and not before in practice, what will occur? They will lose. Pious exercises are increased for the Christian as they come to know more, and the saints are made more fruitful because they have more skill than those who allow their gifts and graces and duties to fall by the wayside in times of ease. And therefore, God brings them into troubles and extremities many times to teach them. Afflictions are compared to rain. As the rain falling on the earth makes it fruitful, it makes the seed to grow. Thomas Mockett said, afflictions that are sanctified will make barren hearts and lives fruitful in grace and all good works. The reason for that is because Christians are like rough, hard ground that's not fit to be used until it's softened and broken, and that the rain that falls will not do it by itself. It must be a shower that soaks through, and it will not soak through well enough until it's plowed up. And afflictions are brought so to soften the Christian and make them more pliable to his blessed will and be more fruitful. That's the reason James says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. And what happens? Knowing this, that the trying of your faith by affliction worketh patience. One grace produces another. But let patience have a perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. James 1, 2-4. If a man pulls off a bandage from a wound too soon, it will not be of any help. Here, let patience, in other words, in bearing afflictions, have its perfect work. Thomas Mockett again said, this implies that if patience has its perfect work, it will make a Christian perfect and entire, lacking nothing. For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he, God, for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Hebrews 12:10. Paul, speaking of affliction, says, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. 2 Corinthians 4:16. As the waters that lifted up the ark, the higher the waves were, the nearer the ark was to heaven. And so afflictions, though they seem to cast men low in the eyes of the world and their own eyes as well, yet they mount a man higher towards God and make him, after a sort, a complete Christian, that they may be perfect and entire. Consider also what might be done in times of ease or times of difficulty. The first easy answer is to follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes. Stay united and grow in grace in him. Follow him no matter what, which is the same to say, follow his commandments. Oftentimes, I think Christians don't even know on occasion whether they're saved and doubt because they don't observe active growth in their life by their pursuit of godliness. If they don't see something occurring in them by way of growth, they wonder, and they wonder, I think, rightly. If a Christian is not growing, they're stagnant, and that in turn brings all kinds of difficulties, whether in times of ease or times of prosperity, which makes them idle, or in times of affliction, which makes them afraid. But if one is following the Lamb here on earth as the church militant, they're pressing into the kingdom. They press into the kingdom as the Father's name is pressed into their foreheads. And they must labor to preserve their union and communion with God by all means, that when any outward changes come, as providences change, and providences will change and come in that way, they will come in one way or another. Such people may say with the apostle, I am afflicted, but not forsaken. A vine, as a vine is connected to the tree in which it clings, grows upward. It continues to grow and mingle itself on the tree. Vines in this way grow and cling and stay closely connected to the tree. If the Christian desires to cling to Christ and follow him whithersoever he goes, it is not to follow him at a later time or another time, but at the present, and continue to do so no matter the days or circumstances. Christians ought not to go to God when they perceive their need of him, and only then, as if afflictions press the Christian to take Jesus off the shelf when it's convenient, and then put him back when they are through. They follow him as the saints do in heaven, whithersoever he goes, all of the time and in every circumstance. They are constant in that and in his religion. And this constancy of the Spirit and the best things in that will be evidence to them that they have found him constant in his love for them. And those times of trouble and affliction will be better if they have already exercised themselves in walking with him. They already know how to do it. They treasure up all the promises for the time to come. And if they don't, they will do what the church in the wilderness had done so many times. Afflictions, not managed well, tend to press out murmurings and despair. Afflictions will always press out what is in the heart. They are to treasure up in times of ease that which is needed in times of afflictions. And the faithful saints follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes, whether in times of ease, in times of affliction. How might we apply it? Well, that's easy. You have to have a strategy in following the Lamb whithersoever he goes at all times. Follow the Lamb circumspectly with wisdom. That's a generality. Is it not your duty that you are not strictly charged to stay in close proximity to Christ? It's not merely by word, but practically. All your actions are expressed by following him and walking whithersoever he goes. It includes all your actions, whether they are spiritual, civil, or natural. It includes actions of religion. It includes actions in all social things. It includes actions that are natural to man or woman. Everything that we've studied in the commandments can be named in this. The Lamb requires you to keep close to him, walk by him, and follow him in all things. Such a following closely and drawing near appears in that it is a forward motion. It is always a forward motion for you as a Christian soldier who has no armor for his back. Such a motion in following the Lamb whithersoever he goes is a progressive motion without consideration of circumstance. You are always rushing into battle. We consider times of ease and times of affliction or hardship, but does that really matter? What a most difficult thing that is for you to do. Always to violently possess the kingdom. The saints in heaven don't have a discrimination or a condition in which they follow the Lamb in times of ease, not follow the Lamb so well in times of affliction or hardship. They follow him whithersoever he goes, no matter how far he goes or where he goes or what circumstances he goes in. It is your constant motion to follow, and it is to be most pleasant as it is for them in heaven. It is the generality of Paul's oversimplification of walking circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. And such walking has rules for you, whether in ease or hardship. It's to follow the Lamb no matter what. It contains knowledge to understand your following, and then wisdom to rightly apply the rule of walking and following no matter what. In this you walk as the saints walk in heaven, whithersoever he goes. You carry on in even course towards heaven. It doesn't matter if the affliction is an affliction, or the providence is an affliction, or times of ease. You're not manic in your walk and following up and down all over the place. You strive for constancy. That's part of the Lord's Prayer. Consistency and constancy and constraining, as you'll see when we study it. The saints in heaven are already in heaven and they walk perfectly. You are not in heaven and you walk imperfectly, but regardless of the providence, good or bad, you constantly walk and you draw nearer and closer day by day. So you have a watchful eye and a trembling heart in your walking. You do it purely, chastely, without guile, with one voice, preferably. There are many people in the church that come short of following Christ whithersoever he goes. They'll follow him in times of ease, but in times of hardship they murmur. Others do little to nothing in times of ease and run to him with violence when things get even a little difficult. In either case, that is all but half-heartedness. And what will partial reformation ever get you? Those that, instead of following the Lamb fully, have their hearts divided. Many rest content in some shows of religion, so they'll follow him in times of ease. Many do not exercise themselves in religion and so run to him in times of difficulty because they're overwhelmed. You are to have a knowledge of following the Lamb whithersoever he goes by the word which instructs you as to how to walk exactly. You are to labor to get a heart sensible of how to walk and that you do not walk out of the way. Wandering in the wilderness, coming under subjection to the mouth of the lion and the paw of the bear is a very terrible thing. Because it requires rescue. It is not like setting yourself under the apple tree with delight. It's not like laying in the feet of the kinsman redeemer. Setting your heart always as in the Lamb's presence and allowing the word of God dwelling richly in your heart is the way to know how to walk. It will give you wisdom. It will give you understanding. It will give you one voice, a thunderous voice, and unity and truth. It is by the word which the Lamb has given his saints and trusted such a love letter to them in the scriptures. So they are constantly in it, constrained by its message and consistent. In this you're armed with a strong persuasion to follow the Lamb because of his covenant sufficiency. For under the blood of the Lamb you have a fullness of strength. And under the blood of the Lamb you have the fullness of all his promises to you. And such proves your wisdom to stay close to him and follow him no matter what. You're persuaded in it. It's your wisdom to walk well in following the Lamb. You propound the right end in doing so, which is for his glory. You make the right use of all his means to do so, which are the tools. You take the safest way, the wisest way, which is the Lamb's way in both ease and hardship. You do it constantly. You do it now with violence, and you do it with great delight. You do it in every situation, no matter what it is, ease or affliction. But take opportunity in times of ease to prepare for affliction. It may not be that times of ease will last long for you, so use your time wisely. You may not have instruction as you do now so readily. You may not have fellowship as you do now. You may not have opportunity as you do now. What lions will be in the way later, you don't know. Improve all times of both ease and affliction for the increase of faith, and grow always. John Flavel said it this way, in times of prosperity, we know not what stock of faith we have. We hang so much upon things seen that we cannot many times tell whether we have faith or not. But when difficult days come, then we must get out our whole substance and livelihood by faith. Yes, then we have many proofs and experiments of God's faithfulness in the promises, which is a choice help to faith. What wisdom is there in just waiting for a trying time to see how well you'll do? Each day affords time that can be gained or lost. We ought then to make use of all times, especially of ease, for the right knowledge of these things and following the Lamb always. You should consider how you follow the Lamb and take an accurate inspection of your life and conversation in it. Consider how you speak, what you do, what you love, what you think about, what fills you up, what makes you happy while you live in the world. See your walk as whether it really follows the Lamb or follows yourself. Be precise in it, even willing to go to the utmost of what every command of the Lamb requires. That's what they do in heaven. God's will is done in heaven, perfectly, to its greatest degree. So on earth, you must mimic it. They do it perfectly, both for its matter and manner, especially laboring as to approve themselves as to the Lamb, no matter where the Lamb goes. They desire to stick close to him, and will do so. And you must know what a difficult life you have right now under this preaching and teaching. Because the more light and the more knowledge you have received from the Lamb, you ought to make more diligent heed that in all things you practice according to Christ's light. You see then how much it is an inexcusable sin to know the truth and not do it. You have to follow the Lamb accurately and wisely. That's where your happiness lies. Not that you walk rashly or indeliberately, but that you see and diligently consider what you are to do in your following of Him. Christians ought to have a sound intention or resolution in their action no matter what they do. All their intentions ought to line up with the will of God. And this is to follow wisely. For the Lamb requires you that you should see and take heed, to see with attention, to diligently consider, so that you can follow Him in all things. There is one brief warning to consider, and that is, the less exact a person who professes to be a Christian follows the Lamb, and the less exact they are to follow the rule of God's word, the greater fools they are in God's esteem. Is that harsh? You might think it's harsh. It doesn't matter so much what Christians say, but what they do, and what reasons they do, what they do, or not. It's always a dubious thing when Christians have to say, I love Jesus, and tell somebody else that. Well, I love Jesus. Oh, no, don't worry about me. I love Jesus. It does not matter so much what Christians say, but what they do. That's James' argument. And do to show what reasons they give to do what they do or not do. It does not matter what the world thinks of them, but if they are destitute of wisdom and they don't follow the Lamb whithersoever He goes as the Lamb so prescribed, where is it that they are walking? It doesn't matter what comes out of their mouth. Is it a wise walking to walk by the Lamb at a distance or to follow Him whithersoever He goes? What will times of ease look like for them? What will times of difficulty look like for them? That's why the Apostle says, see, ye walk circumspectly, not as fools. Is that harsh? He calls those who don't walk wisely fools. Consider such a following and whether it is in accordance with the text. So you see, just in all of this, a very general principle of constancy. The saints follow the Lamb whithersoever He goes in all providences, whether in times of ease or times of hardship. Next time we'll consider the conclusion of following the Lamb, that is, for His own glory. Let's pray together.